This is going to be our second of the season's brown bag seminars, and Jason Hackford is professor of geography and planning at the University of Toronto is our speaker today. A couple of things, Bob's circulating the sign-in sheet. If you're in Michael Glass's class, please make a check mark so that you're properly attended here in terms of attending. And we also have coming up our brown bag seminar series next week. Did everybody get a copy? Mark Heed of the City of Philadelphia, the Chief Data Officer, will be our speaker.
No, that's two weeks.
Oh, no, that's next week. Next week we got Ernie. Ernie Steinberg is next Thursday, a week from yesterday, and he is here. Ernie's in here, and for those of you who are in transportation and infrastructure, we always need to fill the room for a couple of transportation. A Bridge for 1,000 Years, How Planners Should Think About Infrastructure. Ernie Sternberg is a professor at the University of Buffalo and is part of the Urban Regional Planning, so I think that will be a really interesting talk. The following week, Mark, is Mark. November 21st on Thursday, Mark Key, the Chief Data Officer of the City of Philadelphia, and that's in a different location. That'll be at the O'Hara Student Center on O'Hara Street, otherwise formerly known as the Concordia Club. So in 2 weeks, we will be in a different location, so please make note of that. We finish up the fall term with Colleen Kane at the Northeast Midwest Institute. She'll be talking about community benefits agreements and her work in the Hill District. So we look forward to three more exciting seminars before the end of the term. Hard to believe we're almost there. Jason Hackworth, as I said, is professor of geography and urban planning at the University of Toronto and teaches about cities, political economy, and urban policy. He's also affiliated with the Center for the Study of the United States and the Center for Urban and Community Studies. He's currently researching planning and policy issues about declining North American cities, so not a stretch for us to be hosting Jason here in Pittsburgh. And land abandonment, the role of the market, political changes, the government intervention in these contexts are of particular interest to him. And he's written a number of papers and books recently on religion and how the economy collide in the urban landscape. Before going to the University of Toronto 10 years ago or so, he was assistant professor of geography at Florida State University, received his doctorate in geography from Rutgers in 2000 and a master's in planning from Arizona State, a master's in geography from Arizona State, and his bachelor's in sociology from the University of Cincinnati. Jason's a native of Columbus, so he's from within the close-in driving range of Pittsburgh. And his talk today will be contrasting property abandonment strategies in cities and outlines the political and economic debates in these competing strategies in property abandonment. Jason, welcome.
Thank you for having me thorough introduction, and thanks for inviting me. I very much appreciate the opportunity not only to present, but to interact with the conference and meet some of you in more depth after the talk. And I very much see this as kind of a learning process. As I indicated, I'm a bit new to this topic, and I'm still learning everything I can about it. But that's what I have to say. I'm very interested in the perspective of which really those of people are actually working on the ground in the sector and how some of the challenges exist there. And so I think also indicated, I live in Toronto now, although I'm originally from the West. I grew up a few hundred miles west of here, near Columbus, Ohio. I spent the last 11 years in Toronto. Some of my colleagues and students in Toronto wish that I would write a bit more about Canadian cities. I have to admit, over the years, I've stayed very focused on American cities, in large part because I find the intrigue, the controversy, the intensity of American urbanization, to be honest, a bit more compelling. And that the inverse tends to be true about Canadian cities, as Peter, the late actor Peter Ustinov, once called Toronto. It reminded him of New York as though run by the Swiss. It's a quarterly, almost boring city where nothing goes on, evidently until this week. So, I'm about to talk to you for about 50 minutes about land abandonment in Rust Belt cities. I'm fully willing, as you all know, to engage in an in-depth conversation about technical pain smoking, extortion, should you find that to be a more interesting topic. Okay,
could you use the microphone? It's hard to hear you back here. Thanks.
As Sabina indicated, I'm interested right now in land abandonment issues, and what I want to talk about today pertains to some of that research. And I suspect most of you taking an urban studies class, it seems like many of you are in an urban studies class right now, you've seen some variation on this table. It's a very simple table of population changes in some selected cities. Sometimes cities are different, sometimes the years used in these tables are different. But this one is a very basic one that I don't want to belabor too much, but I want to sort of set the table with this as a kind of conversation starting point. And I want to sort of illustrate two things. One, so essentially what you're seeing here is just basically population changes, selected cities, population change in percentage terms, land area, the change in the national rank change, again, selected cities. This isn't the top or the bottom, this is some selected cities, including some of the boulders that we'll talk about more today. Two things that I want to sort of set the table with. One is the scale of the collapse of demand in some places, 50-60% in some population loss in some cities. And I think that that's an important thing that I want to return to, that we're not talking about sort of a marginal thing that might be sort of where marginal kind of policy solutions will go a great deal. There's really been, I don't think it's an overstatement, a collapse of effective demand in certain places, and I want to think about what that means in terms of housing markets that I'll talk more about in a moment. And the second point, and again I'll move past this pretty quickly, is the issue of how some of these figures are actually masked by annexation. There's two cities here in particular, Toledo and Milwaukee, but others where in some ways this is only the tip of the iceberg. In some ways, both in those cities, that there's actually been pretty catastrophic population loss at the census tract level in places that have been able to expand their boundaries, but also even in places that have lost 50-70% of their population have lost more than that in some census tracts. It's more populated in certain locations than others. Population loss is, of course, a very, very, very general beginning to a conversation about this topic of land abandonment. Land abandonment is a much more microscopic microscopic thing that is influenced by population loss and a number of other things as well. I've put together a series of metrics, and I borrowed this from Alan Mollick, who I understand came here a few years ago and adapted some of his thresholds that he used. And basically, he, at the census tract level, he's very clever with data, and at least in my view, he did. And he devised this metric that had sort of four components to it that would essentially assess the degree of market collapse, the market distress, rather, in certain neighborhoods in certain cities. And it was a long way of saying that there are certain neighborhoods that he argued, and as do I in some cases, where there is no sort of functioning market. We need to think about that at a broad level. There's four components to this, and I'll briefly go through them. I'd be happy to spell them out in more detail during the Q&A period if you wish, but basically one is low sales cost. We use the threshold of under 50,000. I realize that's a very high figure for some neighborhoods, but we'll come back to why that's important in a second. Low sales volume, the idea being that, again, he and others have argued that 6-7%, depending on where you are, the housing stock, and he sort of suggested somewhat natural, goes up for sale in a given year. If you're getting only up, half of that that's selling, there's a suggestion that a lot of it's going to essentially be abandoned or walked away from. Investor-dominated activity, when you have, you can measure the number of originated mortgages. Most people who buy houses to live in them use a mortgage. Most people who buy houses to invest in either use cash or some non-originated mortgage metric. Looking at cases where the investor-dominated activity is greater than 75% for a given census tract in a given year. And housing vacancy, a much more conventional figure, 25% or above. Now, I'm going to show you a series of maps. And what I've done here is to use those aforementioned metrics
and to sort of group them together so that those that I deem as severely distressed have three or four of those characteristics. Those that are moderately distressed have one to two. If you follow housing markets, those are all pretty serious indicators by themselves, but that's moderate distress is one to two of those characteristics, and not distressed has none of those characteristics. And so I'm going to show you a series of maps, and again, in appreciation for the time and the other things that I want to get to today, really I'm just sort of trying to show off my RA's work. But also, it's just to kind of get the sense of the scale. We can think about population loss, but how does it percolate down, and how does it actually influence what we might think of as something closer to the neighborhood scale? Census tracts are a bit bigger than that in some cases, but we'll think about it more or less as the neighborhood scale. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with any single one of these, but basically there's a before after with each one of these cities, before being the beginning of the recession, 2007, and then another is 2010, and that's going to be a proxy for essentially the bottom, realizing that that more mayhem happened after that in some cities. Okay, so Flint, Michigan, you can see that this is one of the places that we refer to in the literature as doing the right things and having a lot of really interesting institutions and reforms that have dealt with climate change. This is 2017, the recession, more or less the end of the bubble. You can see that there was a lot of the city that was actually either moderately or severely distressed at that time. You jump forward to 2010, all but one of the census tracts is in that condition, and that the existing pockets of severe distress had broadened and deepened. Gary, Indiana, it's even worse, the transition. This was 2007. You can see that there are some non-distressed tracts in 2007. We fast forward to 2010. The entire city was either moderately or severely distressed, at least using those indicators. And that, just to remind you, is that it has at least, every single one of the census tracts had at least one of those pretty serious indicators. Detroit, the icon of all icons when we talk about this topic, we'll talk more about it in a moment, is a place in 2007 that it was struggling, though there was some struggling in a very serious way. Almost all of its census tracts, all of its neighborhoods were either moderately or severely distressed, but the severe distress was sort of concentrated, as you can see, in a number of locations, and there were what seemed to be some census tracts that had some promise, it looks like, in 2007. By 2010, there was only one census tract in the whole city that didn't have one of these criteria that I described before, and the existing pockets of severe distress had broadened significantly. Places like Cleveland, that had actually had more investment in the form of some nefarious investment, but investment nonetheless, in the early part of the decade, in the housing market, it was more of a checkerboard pattern of distress, non-distress, and severe distress. Much of this significant problems were in the eastern half of the city. By 2010, almost the entire eastern half of the city is either moderately or severely distressed, and there's a lot of research about what exactly is happening on a more microscopic level there. And the numbers of non-distressed tracts are significantly decreased. St. Louis, a bit more concentrated, a bifurcated city, almost in a very literal sense, the southern side of the city, having less housing distress up to 2007, and by 2010, a deepening, and a bit of an extension of the existing struggles that had existed on the ground. The last three cities I'm going to show you, Buffalo, Rochester, and Pittsburgh, actually are interesting in that time period that I'm looking at, 2007 to 2010. These are the only three who actually had a bit of a price, overall price increase, or there's price indices that the federal government puts out, housing market in general is doing, where moderate price increases in all three of those places. But again, I think it's just sort of a reminder that we can look at the sort of meta statistics and it only gives part of the story. This is Buffalo in 2007. Buffalo in 2010, you can see much of the state's contained to east of Maine, which is where the heavy disinvestment has occurred over the years. Rochester is a bit more concentrated around the core, the more severe distress extends, the moderate distress extends a bit as well. Here in Pittsburgh, again, dissimilar in the sense that it's not sort of one half of the city, but the transition of deficit occurs. There's sort of an expansion around existing nodes that had been in severe distress before. Now, the reason I show these is that, you know, these are, again, fairly meta in their approach, right? This doesn't necessarily tell us anything about land per se, but people like Alan Paul and myself are interested in these because they are both an indication of places that are have had a great deal of land somewhere across these borders, but also places where that is likely to occur in the future, where the market seems to be or could head in that direction. But even there, I think it's a legitimate argument can be made that, you know, what we're measuring here is kind of an abstraction in a sense. It's not necessarily, doesn't have anything necessarily to do with individual houses and how they are or are not abandoned. And so much of the research, including the things that I'm currently doing, is about sort of trying to trace properties as they become physically abandoned. There's a whole literature that some of you are probably familiar with, real estate-owned literature, properties that have basically gone through mortgage foreclosure. I've been particularly interested in tax foreclosure. I think it's a fairly different market, and I'll show you some maps that indicate that in a moment. But I think it's a particularly acute form of abandonment that occurs, and I'm going to show you some work that we've done, myself and a research assistant have been doing on Toledo, Ohio, which is a city that we call it, have a huge population decrease, but it's a place that's had its struggles, sometimes we lose sight of the fact that there's, you know, there's pockets of disinvestment, intense pockets of disinvestment, intense pockets of land abandonment in cities that might otherwise sort of pass on to look at other more apocalyptic circumstances like in other cities. So this is Toledo in 2007. This is by 2010, there was an expansion, but most of the heavy, severe distress was located in and around the center, the core of the city, which is sort of the downtown area here on the river. Most of it, you know, the most severe stuff is in the inner core. What we did was to look at the tax foreclosure process, and again, the tax foreclosure process looks a little bit different in every state. Generally, it's a state-level matter that is sometimes it's county, sometimes it's even a city-level matter, depending upon where you are in the U.S. But most of the laws are actually made at the state level. And the way it works in Lucas County, which is the county that houses Toledo, is that basically there are several steps to the process. The first of which is that basically if you don't pay your taxes for more or less a year, there are some exceptions. The county is entitled to file a lien against your property. They're rarely this aggressive, but they're legally entitled to do so. 60 days after which they can send a lien to be sold at a sheriff's auction. If it sells, the minimum bid at that sheriff's auction is the minimum, is the taxes that have, tax debt that's been accrued. So if you've not paid your bill for 5 or 6 years, they have a $10,000 back tax payment to the county. $10,000 is going to be the minimum bid at that auction. This is a map of all of the sheriff auctions, the location of the actual property that actually sold in this event. So this is an event where these are the properties that actually sold for the value of their taxes or more, and it includes mortgage foreclosure, right? So this is actually a larger event, a hybrid event that does a number of different things, including tax foreclosure and mortgage. This is a map of from 1991 to present of the location of those properties. You can see that there's some concentration around these neighborhoods. We were discussing before that the heavily disinvested distressed neighborhoods in and around the core, but there's some dispersion to it as well. The next step in the process, if that property does not sell, and in certain neighborhoods it often does not sell, is to a second stage. In Lucas County, it's called a forfeiture auction. In other places, it's called a secondary auction, discount auction. There's different things that it's called, but it's essentially a process in which the county says, we can't get $10,000 for this property, using the previous example. Let's discount it to a certain level that maybe we can get some market interest. And many places have some variation on this. They usually set the bid at a different level because there's a certain percentage of properties that just sell. And we are very interested in what that percentage is. How much are we talking about? How many properties are we talking about over how long of a period, or how much are they concentrated? This is that sample, and it's basically 4,500-ish properties, some of which have been gone through the site twice over a 20-year period. In Toledo, Ohio, it's likely much, much greater in places like, it's certainly much greater in absolute terms and probably much greater in relative terms in the more disinvested situations like before. The other thing I want to show you here is it's much more concentrated truth, too. This is the, these are the properties that are, and it much more corresponds to the market collapse figures that, that I talked about before. So while it's, you know, it's hard to get data at this scale at, for every city that I showed you before, one would suspect that you would, if you could, you would get a very similar map of, you know, the most challenging tax abandoned properties are very much concentrated in certain neighborhoods. Now, what we did, our sort of goal was to sort of, you know, explore the extent to which, you know, what's happening to these 4,500 properties. What, you know, who buys them? What happens to them? Do they achieve goals that we as state planners or activists might be interested in, like building affordable housing or housing at all? Do they achieve the goals that the assessor's office, which the assessor's office in most cases just doesn't care about those sorts of things, they care about just getting back on the goals. How well does it do that? So we did a number of things. I'd be happy to send you a longer paper if you want to kind of rush through this part a little bit, because it's sort of a long way leading to what I think is a more interesting policy discussion later. But we did a number of things, including kind of categorizing the buyers and then the current owners of these properties, and this very much corresponds with other research that's been done on this. But basically, was interested in, you know, how well you know, current owners, how many of this inventory, how many of these parcels have tax-paying owners. We divided it into two categories: professional and individual investors. Professional investors being builders and LLCs and all sorts of things that come to auction. Sometimes they may have seen this elsewhere. We have their addresses, their current mailing addresses, so we're able to match that up with how close that is to the parcel. And you can see if you follow this, these numbers probably aren't shocking, but they're dismal compared to other things, and other cities, that the percent that are on the tax delinquent list. And this list, mind you, these are eligible properties that can go back into the foreclosure system. These are all certified delinquent parcels. There's relatively different figures. Again, you can see some of them, 35.5% of professional investors. Professional investor-owned parcels are delinquent or national / global. That is professional investors who are located outside of the state of Ohio or outside of the United States. They're 45.3% of them are tax delinquent, so they're purchased and they're not paying the taxes. Individual investors, which can range from owner-occupiers to people living in Canada or Saudi Arabia, anywhere, purchasing this stuff online, is even more dismal. 43.7 overall ended up on this list in 2013, and it ranges, it's quite varied depending on where they're located, but even owner-occupiers, 39.8%, individual neighborhood investors, and by that I mean people who own property in the same zip code, usually next door to themselves, a side lot, something like that, they're nearly 40%, sorry, 32% are on the tax delinquent list, and it goes, relatively dismal figures overall. This, though, doesn't tell us much, and so this can give you a sense of, you know, we're not talking about, this is, you know, the prevailing policy directions, you know, at least as it operates through the assessor's offices to, you know, kind of get this stuff back out of the market. This is what the market is, in a sense. It's not actually, and just by comparison, something less than 10% of all parcels in Toledo are delinquent, so these are all significantly above that. That doesn't tell us, though, much about auction as a mechanism, right? It doesn't say much, but a lot of these people, or individuals or professional investors, may have come into those or purchased those parcels, not necessarily at an auction. So we were able to do a kind of more detailed property history for each of those 4,500 parcels that have gone through the system, and to kind of consider who bought it, you know, and classify them in a way that we were doing. professional investors, individual investors, housing nonprofits, and no buyer. And by no buyer, I mean that nobody bought it even at the minimum bid, which I forgot to mention what the minimum bid. The minimum bid in Lucas County is $40. So that's $40 you can't get rid of this. There is essentially no price to it. I mean, at least an exchange value, and yet hundreds that do not sell at that rate. So this is government absorption of this. We did a number of chi-square tests, chi-square, just to sort of assess whether or not different categories of buyers led to different ratios of outcomes. And, you know, there's basically two categories I want to show you today. Again, there's more in this paper that are going to be happy to send anyone who's more interested in this. But two categories. One is, did it generate redevelopment? What's the likelihood that there was a house built on that parcel after it was purchased, even if it wasn't by the professional or the individual investor themselves? What's the likelihood that, you know, an individual invest, you know, purchases something at an auction and then, you know, 5 years later has a house on it? And you can see that overall, if you're not familiar how to read these tables, that there's a couple things that I would point out. One is that the overall rate, the actual frequency of those, where that actually occurred, new development after a tax auction, is 200 out of 3,100 cases. So, you know, very low rates overall. And that those that are nominally built, right, professional investors, it was 11 out of 377 times that they purchased at an auction. Individual investors whose needs, admittedly, are very often very different. They're often buying a side lot, not necessarily interested in building something. It's 51 out of almost 2,000 parcels that were purchased. There were lower rates overall, but the one that I want to draw your attention to is this no buyer list, which is a category, which is basically in Toledo, in those cases where even at $40 they couldn't find a buyer, it would revert to the public, as it does in most locations in the U.S. and Canada. And then it would appear on a property list, a real estate office list, that would and the city would then try to assemble or use existing relationships to try to get a nonprofit to help build or even for profit. But it was a much more organized process. They were grossly unfunded. It was nothing like the scale or the sophistication of current modern day land banks, but it was basically just kind of slowing the process down. In that instance, there was the highest number, although not the highest rate, of instances where that occurred, that there was actually development that eventually resulted on that parcel. The highest rate was for housing nonprofits, but they, of course, are very low capacity in Toledo and in most locations, so it's hard to see that as kind of an overall policy option. So this, in terms of generating new development, it's not particularly effective for doing that. Many economists, tax assessors, and the like would say it's just unfair to assess it that way, right? There's people like Alan Mollick and Glazer at Harvard who argue that, you know what, the last thing that the neighborhoods we're talking about need is more housing. There's an oversupply of housing in certain neighborhoods, and they would argue that new development is both conceptually or sort of normatively problematic. And others would argue that it's conceptually problematic because tax assessors, it's not their proximate goal. Their proximate goal is to get the property back under the tax rolls. And if you call, I don't know if anybody works in tax assessor offices here, but if you talk to tax assessors, or at least the ones that I've spoken to, they're sort of confused when I start asking them about how it links to planning goals or housing goals. It's just about getting it back under the rolls. So we try to assess that, right? Like how well, according to this category, how well does it actually return to the rules? This particular subset, this is not the whole, range of the things that they do, but this particular subset, the most severely distressed parcels in a particular city. And, it's relatively dismal figures as well. Basically, we assessed, this is a composite metric that includes whether A, the property was eventually delinquent again, that is, did it go back through the process? Was there a subsequent forfeiture again, even if it wasn't delinquent, or even if it didn't make it delinquent partway? Was it ever owned by a public entity? So there's probably other ways. This actually misses some forms of where something might not return to the role for cleaning. So it's a fairly conservative way to assess this. And, you know, there's relatively dismal results in terms of the efficacy of the auctions at kind of generating the central outcome where they're talking about the goal of assessor's office, that professional investors, it was statistically expected results, but still less than half of the time did the parcels that they were purchased by professional investors stay off of the public rolls? Did they stay and cleanly return to the rolls? Individual investors was even worse. What I think is the most interesting category, again, is this no buyer, government absorption of property. Basically, that there's it more often, in both relative and absolute terms, the parcels that did not generate a buyer, but they sort of were passively absorbed by the Toledo land bank, were more likely than any of the other categories to stay off of, you know, stay on the tax rolls to achieve the public policy goals just by default selling in a more organized way after the auction. So,
sure. Maybe showing this later, but are they concentrated in or the way, I mean, if someone is in the plus, if their land based folks are trying to park, you know, to put together bigger parcels?
They weren't, this is pre Lucas Young Land Bank, which they are more proactively now trying to acquire certain parcels. I will talk more about that later, because this is the what people call the first generation land bank, which they weren't really, they were just kind of ownership facilities, essentially, and they weren't necessarily picking and choosing. So I think that in some ways that sort of highlights the fact that there's even with that just kind of passive absorption, there was a better chance that it was sort of achieving the outcome that we talked about. But I will come back to that, because I do think that that's an important point to raise, that there is a new generation that's sort of coming online that we can think about what they can or cannot sort of achieve. You know, one of the bottom lines, you know, the auction process is, you know, appears, at least in its sort of pure let anybody join in type of form, to be generating worse outcomes than simply absorbing and banking the land, then selling and transferring it later in a more organized way. Housing nonprofits, as both buyers and eventual owners, have a relatively good record, but their capacities are low. And keep in mind, these numbers are likely amplified in cities that have struggled with more decisions. So, you know, the question remains, where does this come from? What's the way out? What is the sort of policy being pulled out of this? And I've been told that some of you are involved with some of the conversations in Pennsylvania and in the land banking legislation. And so some of you are probably more familiar than I with how that's sort of operating on the ground, but there is something that I think we can think about this more than just Pennsylvania or New York, Ohio, these other places. But it's a bit of a movement that I think most practitioners in the field would not be terribly surprised by those numbers. They know that the auctions are oftentimes by certain types of speculation that they've been trying to root out for years and have only now gotten the attention of state legislatures in that process. But there is a bit of a movement, and it's, I would argue, there's a movement, land banking legislation that's been enacted in the last 10 years in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Missouri, among other places. There's a lot of variation on the ground. I do want to make a few general points about what some of this legislation is doing to sort of group it together, what it does and what it doesn't do. And one of the things is it provides cities and counties with institutions to absorb tax delinquent parcels and resell, reconfigure, assemble that land, make it beautiful. And most of them have this as an emphasis, right? That they're trying to sort of figure out a way of kind of doing essentially the same thing with a bit more management involved than an auctions would have. To build on existing relationships with nonprofits, to build affordable housing on this land when they can. And the third is that they often, though I understand that there's still, this is the next battle in the state of Pennsylvania, but in one of the other states, that the legislation has actually been accompanied by tax reversion legislation reforms, which, among other things, expedite the process and allow intervention at different stages that were not available before. So, in fact, to Sabina's point, that the land banks, that they didn't have a choice of just sort of absorbing it at the end of the cycle. They can sort of pick and choose at different stages in the cycle based on whether it's certified delinquent. It doesn't have to go through the cycle. And the fourth thing, very important, to provide some funding vehicles that were, that weren't available before at the county level access to property, to tax penalties, that some funding mechanisms, to rentals of property that you're allowed to do in Pennsylvania, that some other states are not allowed to do, to actually buy and rent these sorts of things. And so some interesting changes. So I guess the problem is solved. I guess we all go home. There's a lot of people talking about this right now, right? About, you know, what are some of the things that this does or does not do? And one of the things I've been interested in the research that I've been doing, and I've kind of have a piece coming out in Progress of Planning early 2014, but it's about the kind of the legislative battle that took place for some of this legislation and what sorts of compromises were made, what sorts of exceptions were made, what does the emphasis with the existing land banks that result from this, what are they emphasizing? My argument would be, and is in this piece, that there's still quite a bit of a market orientation to these things. I do not want to denigrate anything that land banks are doing right now. I really mean that. I think that it does meaningfully root out certain forms of speculation that were making things palpably worse before. But I do think that in large part because of the legislation that crafted a number of the land banks, that they retain a market orientation, and that, you know, that many have to be self-funded, many are self-financed, many have strict limitations on how long they can bank property, they have restrictions on they have to sort of turn it over to sort of some independent or usually private entity. My own sense, and this is again perhaps I'm alone on this, but I don't think I am in some ways, that the larger scale of the collapse of demand that we kind of started with is too great in my view to kind of retain this emphasis exclusively. There needs to be something else and a more assertive, in particular, a more assertive governmental response. There's a lot of ways we can think about what that response might be. But I want to sort of, you know, I sort of pondered the question of why that emphasis has been retained. What is it about that emphasis? Why are they kind of set up in this particular way, and where does that come from, and what's stopping a more of an assertive governmental response? And there's a lot of answers to that question. I want to talk about two very briefly that might that at least in my view. Just a quick pop quiz. I know some of you are in urban studies class. Can anyone tell me who is photographed here? Frederick Hayek. So he's Frederick Hayek, and if you would like to purchase this, wake up to this hand in place every morning. You can purchase this from the Cato Institute website. This is a poster that they sell at a gift shop. It was from the Forbes magazine cover from 1997, which was celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Mont Pelerin Society, which was a group of very, what we now call, conservative economists. They called themselves liberals. They called themselves liberals because they thought they were the true liberals, in that liberalism was classical liberalism. Liberalism was a lot of human, not the stuff that immediate people in this country and liberals in Canada started calling themselves egalitarian liberals. They thought that was really stuff that they really thought that the market should be the center of everything, that government policy was going to distort everything. And, you know, they were, you know, fairly radical at the time, but they became, their ideas percolated into the mainstream in many ways. And there's a lot of think tanks that are actually devoted to expressing their ideas in a variety of senses. There's a lot of uses of this term, and I'm just going to give a simple one. I'd be happy to talk more about it in Q&A, but again, I want to move on. But by neoliberalism, I'm referring to here is this embrace of property, an embrace of market, and a repudiation of government measures, almost no matter what they look like, at achieving social policy goals or anything in this context. I think of it as, you know, there are self-professed libertarians, but not very many self-professed liberals. It's a label that's been used by social scientists like myself to refer to it. But I think of it as more than just sort of a self-identified label. I think of it as a strategy, as an idea, as something that sort of percolates through in a variety of different ways. You might justifiably ask, what in the heck does this have to do with land abandonment in any of the cities that we're talking about? And that would be a justifiable question. There are some ways that, and I don't think it's the central force, and we're talking about some of the other things that are influencing this policy picture from my view. But I do think it is a part of the picture. And there are some, what we might think of as straight line connections between these two ideologies and the legislation that has occurred. Then there are some less direct ones that I'll talk about in a moment. But some of the straight line considerations, there are think tanks, right? The Show Me Institute, this picture here, whose tongue twisting motto is advancing liberty with responsibility by promoting market solutions to Missouri public policy, that contested unsuccessfully the attempt in Missouri to expand its land banking legislation. Contested it unsuccessfully in the sense that they weren't able to stop it outright, but they were able to kind of highlight some issues. So there was, and they're interesting. The reason I highlight them, there are others at the state level. The reason I highlight them is that in their reports, they're directly invoking Hayek, they're indirectly invoking Milton Friedman, they're indirectly invoking the evils of government, and it, at a very broad ideological level. There are others, though, that are more interested on the ground, sort of, changing in more subtle ways, and most of the time, remind me that this approach doesn't work in the Missouri case in terms of derailing the legislation, but it did highlight some issues that I would argue got dealt with at the legislative level. There are others like the Hudson Institute, you may have heard of it, it's a more of a regional think tank, and the Mackinac Institute, which is a Michigan-based think tank, actually not just influenced, they actually wrote the Michigan land bank legislation for, at the time, the Republican legislature at the time. Now, and it had a number of different features. My student, who just now at the University of Michigan Dearborn, just came out with a piece in urban geography if you're interested more in the Hudson Institute, Mackinac Institute. They're both member organizations. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the group, Allied, the group that basically funds state level think tanks to write legislation for conservative causes. So, yeah, there are some straight line connections, but I would argue that this often happens in more, in less directly. So the invocation of these ideas of property market, the dangers of getting government involved in any sense, often happens in more subtle ways and by more interest group affiliated ways. Banking groups, real estate, investor groups, realtor groups that were part of the rest of the match that led to the legislation in this state. They're often not successful. They weren't in this case. They did oppose it in the Pennsylvania case. They did oppose it in the Illinois case, the Real Estate Agents Association and the Allied Group in Illinois. They weren't successful here at stopping it, but they were part of the conversation as far as I was told by some people at Pelley. But in Illinois, they were actually successful in derailing it. When it's occurred, there have been, tweaks and this and that made to achieve consensus. Self-financing is one, detailed restrictions on what can be acquired and where, how long that parcel can be banked, limitations on other powers like renting, eminent domain, acting as buyers at auctions. These have all been sort of added to recent land banking legislation. Some are in some states, some are not. So there is some influence on this level. I think, though, and I personally, have written a bit about that topic, about how just the idea of skepticism for government is communicated and used as a tactic to kind of distort policy formation at a kind of legislative level. I do think, though, it would be incomplete, if not irresponsible, to suggest that that sentiment somehow owned by the Cato Institute, that sentiment, when it comes to this particular topic in particular, and I want to just sort of, there's other elements of skepticism for what the alternative might be to, say, more market-oriented processes. And I think that one of the most relevant within this policy domain is the lingering, you might call it a hangover from the urban renewal era. Urban renewal is a lot of things, and I think sometimes we've reduced it to a caricature in some ways. I don't think that it was a singular thing and that it got applied in the same way in every city, but there were some things that I do think complicate the policy formation picture today, particularly at the local level. That period was marked by, development agencies were set up. They assertively used eminent domain to clear sites in anticipation of new development that often did not come. to build housing that was often worse for its residents than the housing they demolished, to build expressways that cut through perfectly functional neighborhoods. And of course, this fell disproportionately on African-American neighborhoods. And this is the main point for me, is that it largely set the table for a period of profound distrust when it comes to this topic of what is going to be done with abandoned land, or how much land will then, you know, when it comes to demolition and development, all sorts of things on the ground. So I don't want to suggest that the sort of orientation of the entire legislative environment when it comes to urban policy in general, or particularly land banking, or dealing with highly disinvested neighborhoods, is exclusively complicated by neoliberal think tanks at the state level or the federal level, though I do think that there is something going on there. I think that this picture is complicated in general by a variety of forces. That there's a almost across the spectrum, there's a skepticism, if not hostility, to the mobilization of government, particularly municipal government, to address certain problems. I'd like to suggest two things, though, that I think, part of this picture, coming back to that very simple table I started with, that I think the scale of abandonment, the scale of, is too great to retain this emphasis. How are we about here? This is where we are. And I do think that retaining emphasis on making better markets, there's a lot of ground that can be covered there. But in my view, it's not enough just to cover the 60-70% of population loss that's formed as a fundamental demand problem in a number of locations. And there's only so much ground that can be covered, ground that should be covered, by sort of finding better buyers, marketing properties. I'd also like to suggest an even more controversial point, and that is that we can learn something from Detroit. I'm not sure how many of you have paid attention to, if you study Detroit, there was a very interesting group, it's a public-private group of activists and corporations, motley group of residents and city officials. They got together in the last several years, and under the auspices of this organization, Detroit Works. And they put together this plan that was just released about a year ago, and it was called Detroit Future City. And I was just sort of flipping through it as a map geek. It's got some great, really interesting, colorful maps, really high production value. I'm still trying to figure out who paid for all this, because it's a very interesting exercise, but it just seems suspiciously too slick for me. But anyway, there's something when you flip through it that there's this category they keep using, and I was sort of very curious about. They call it innovation ecological. I've never heard of that. This is a larger plan that's sort of dealing with a lot of things, employment, land use, and this fell under their land use category. And this is something that they, this is a category that they were suggesting that exists. And I was reading, what is innovation ecological? It's basically allowing certain parts of the city to return to nature, in a sense, and not just sort of allowing, which is already the case and much of it already, but actually codifying that, right, to make it certain parts of the city literally unbuildable. So it's not that you're just sort of like waiting for new investors to come along, to actually set aside certain districts, certain zones of the city as innovation ecological, and to use not only these zones, but corridors along expressways. And I thought, well, okay, that sounds controversial, but let's see how much they're talking about. And then I nearly had a stroke when I saw how much they're talking about. This is the PDF is not very, this is a screen snapshot, so it's not an easy thing to see. But I'll just sort of point out the locations in a moment. And it's a very bad coloration scheme that they use, but basically this is, this area here, this area here, this area here, this area here are all zones that they're essentially going to declare as sort of, this is a formal city plan, that they're suggesting be declared innovation ecological in the sense that it's, and they're not talking about relocating, anyone, you're entitled, they're very clear about that, but that they're essentially talking about decommissioning large parts of the city, and a lot of the land is already city-owned. Unless you think that this is a some eco-socialist fantasy concocted by people like me, consider that it has grown, drawn the support of a motley coalition of people, and for very different reasons. Business leaders and economists have argued that it would create more scarcity and a more plausible pathway to a revived housing market by generating scarcity. Environmentalists and city management types argue that it could decrease the amount of impermeable surface in the city and help with stormwater management. It could also act as a carbon sink, which is why they're talking about doing this along expressways. Community activists argue that such land could be used collectively for gardens and just clean open spaces. In other cities, Youngstown, Saginaw, I'm just reading about Cleveland talking about doing this. Rochester's flirting with something as well, are talking about something similar, though nothing even approaching the scale of this. I would like to suggest that some component of land decommissioning has to be part, and I don't think that sounds so negative, but that sounds so like a, but needs to be part of the path forward. I want to make it clear, I'm not suggesting as the word works is that we write up whole zones of the city, but I am saying that it's as practical to consider smaller scale versions of this in other cities as it is to expect the market to return in the way that it was structured before. I guess I'll be solved now. We can all right now. Obviously, it's not. There's some serious concrete obstacles, and I don't want to diminish those. Among those, most land banks don't, and probably ought not, by themselves, have the legal or practical ability to do this. Housing values for affordable housing activists, essentially what's being argued here is, at least by the business leaders, is that it will increase house values, which isn't exactly welcome news to those who are on fixed incomes. So affordable housing ought to be part of, or a central part of any of this, if it's going to be imposed or enacted. And there are real legal issues that urban lawyers have talked about. Does this constitute a taking? There's all sorts of things. Again, this is all the land that's being discussed is publicly owned land. So there's serious concrete issues with this, and I don't want to diminish any of those, but I'd like to end with what we might think of as much less concrete, but perhaps more impactful than any of this. And this is something that certainly I'm not the first to highlight this point. There's a lot of intriguing city literature talking about this kind of culture of growth or the associations we make with population growth and the associations we make with that not happening, what this represents and how challenging it is to sort of revert public opinion on this topic. And that is that there's a sort of belief that a kind of bustling market-oriented path is equals success and rigidly, and just the opposite, that emptiness or slowness equals failure or even worse. And it's rife across the political spectrum, and in my view, it's reinforced in media culture. When Rush Limbaugh, don't roll your eyes, learned that Flint, Michigan, in 2009, was thinking about demolishing 40% of its housing stock, he lamented hysterically that it was like living in a totalitarian regime. He might be dismissed, or he might be excused for dismissing such hysteria were it not repeated by other more reasonable commentators. When Bob Herbert, formerly of the New York Times, learned of this exact same program, so it's apples to apples comparison, he wrote a column in the New York Times, and Colin Mollick is still frustrated about this column as well, but he wrote, the city of Detroit, this Bob Herbert, not Alma, the city of Detroit is using federal money to destroy thousands upon thousands of empty homes, giving in, and it says at this point, giving in to a sense of desperation that says there's no way to rebuild the city, so let's do the opposite. Let's destroy even more of it, lots more of it. It's difficult to know what to do with such statements. It's also difficult to dismiss them. They respond to and drive the narrative that exists, and they're tapping into something that is very real, and I think that it's... in my view, it limits the range of imagination, the things that the policy vehicles that we can bring to bear on this to only those that are either market friendly or market only in their orientation. So just in closing, just to sort of end with this point, recent calls to remove property from the market in places like Detroit, Saginaw, Youngstown, they feel like desperate act, right? They feel like paradoxes if the proximate goal is to grow the economy and improve tax receipts. But it could be argued just as plausibly, in my view, that retaining a land market that was built for 2 to 3 times the number of residents contributes to an oversupply of housing, it contributes to a further contraction of tax revenues and to a dispersal of the small landlord investment that does exist. The details of implementation would, of course, have to be local. Simply translating Detroit's vision in any other city wouldn't, and it shouldn't, work. But it has to be local. But I would argue that it equally also has to involve a significant role for government. The scale of the problem in Detroit, in places like Detroit, is staggering, but for there to be any organization to the response, in my view, we have to liberate ourselves from the notion that any form of organization returns us to the urban renewal era if we're an urban activist, or to a road to serfdom if we're a neoliberal think tank, or to a surrender to failure if you're a New York Times columnist. Whatever the model, in my view, it needs to shift from the question, how do we make places grow again, to how do we make places better? I for one, don't think the two are synonymous. In this particular case, I would actually argue that they work against one another. Thank you.
We're going to take questions now, and when you do have your question, you can introduce yourself. So I know there's a big group of congressmen, all kinds of folks in the room, so feel free to get started.
Donald Simpson, history of retina. I have about 3 hours worth of questions, so that's still in Detroit. But I was curious about your terms. You used the word housing, and then you used the word disinvestment. I was wondering what the relationship is, if you're including disinvestment, obviously commercial real estate and other. You showed a slide of, I think it was the Michigan Central Terminal, which is not a private residence. It's a public or semi-public railroad-owned thing. So what are you including in disinvestment?
I'm not formally in this study, no, but I certainly that the two are inextricably connected. I would suggest otherwise, but you know, in the metrics that I'm using, the focus right now is on housing, and I see those as, you know, that, but I see that form of disinvestment is flowing very directly from the incredible job losses, right? I don't want to suggest that they're somehow bifurcated, or that they're two different subjects at all.
Denny Pucco with the PA Department of Community and Economic Development. If you're just looking at the drop in demand based on population loss, are you, number one, missing the fact that that's tempered by the fact that households are changing? So it's really not a drop in demand equal to the population loss. It's a little less than that because the size of households are now smaller. And then secondly, are you taking into account the projected growth? Isn't the nation, aren't the people that understand these things projecting the United States growing another 100 million people in, I don't know whether it's 20, 30 years or so, and how will those people be accommodated? And is that not an opportunity that would change the whole market perspective for the urban places?
Yeah. And I just wanted you to raise this point because it's the paper that I'm trying to write right back home, which is on this issue of how does household size change this picture. Because you're right, if you look at, there has been one scholar, Brent Ryan, who's looked at this in some detail using a couple of cities, but essentially the household sizes, if we think about them in percentage terms, they've dropped by about 20 or 30%. And so how does that influence it? So there's certainly, we might think about it in that respect. And I think we can calibrate some of this to occurring, you know, some of what we're seeing in that sense. I would say the point about projected growth in some ways works both ways. I understand you're talking about it as a sort of future thing, right? That is sort of, but I think about sort of the overall growth, that in some ways it's true that there's been a household size decline, but there's also been at the same time since 1950 a pretty large national growth that's occurred over time. So yes, there's been a fact that might indicate that it's that the level of abandonment is less than, you know, the number of housing units may say that are closer to similar rate, but there's been so much extra growth elsewhere that it's that the relative decline in population is actually much greater. I'm sensitive to the point that which I, is a future point, which is that, what are we, closing off the possibility by, approaching this in this particular way? And I'm just, by the way, I mean, there's others. I know Alan Mollick has been, he's writing everything about this stuff right now, but he's been very out there to suggest that the big thing has to be demolition. That's where a lot of the money is right now. There's some settlements from the subprime crisis stuff out at the state level, and there's a lot of emphasis on demolition. And it's got criticized for the same reason, right? That what are we doing, with this housing stock that could be potentially used? And I guess I think about it in a couple ways. That one is that I'm not exactly sure what we're supposed to do in the meantime. That could occur, it might not. It might, if it does, it might take 30 or 4 years. But I guess I also think that we don't necessarily have to think of these things as mutually exclusive. That some of the most valued public spaces in cities are essentially things that are off the market. Central Park, there's conservation areas. And one of the slides that I clipped that I wanted to show you guys just to kind of give you a sense, it kind of raises this point, is that we assume that it's failure to have emptiness in poor neighborhoods, but there was a real estate ad from my city in Toronto where there was this very modest house I wanted to show you that looked very similar to the backyard, looked very similar to east side of Detroit, Buffalo, and I was just there a few weeks ago. And I wanted to show you, it was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, very modest looking house. They won $1,250,000 for it, and they're probably going to get it. And the reason that they're going to get it is because they back onto a conservation area, specifically because they can't build there. And I'm not economic development type. I'm not sort of suggesting that that's the high point of urbanization, but I am suggesting that the way we think about this, that it doesn't necessarily have to preclude that possibility, because it could be a better place that's created. It could be some, more open space, more green space. That, yes, let's say that, Buffalo or Detroit becomes a much more popular place for new immigrants or natural growth. It doesn't necessarily mean that it precludes the possibility of maybe more dense environments that are next to parks now, rather than being, thousands upon thousands of relatively inexpensively built road houses. That so I'm sensitive to the point, but I'm not convinced that it necessarily cuts that off. To be on that panel.
When we're talking about this, do you take into account the psychocultural cost of the decommissioning? I mean, Detroit is an area that's kind of different in the sense that there's wide swaths and areas. But let's say in areas where wild spaces may have been abandoned, there's still, a number of people still living there. So when you have areas that are still sparsely populated and not as abandoned, what would be the psychic cost of government from a public policy perspective looking to decommission areas in that sense?
I think it depends on what we mean by decommissioning. If we mean trying to clear entire areas, invoking eminent domain, forcing a relocation, I think the psychic cost would be enormous, negative, and awful. It would be a reincarnation of urban renewal. I don't think that, and I want to be clear, I'm certainly not advocating that. And I don't think that, I'm certain that the Detroit Works folks are not advocating that. There have, every once in a while, somebody will run their mouth and suggest that, yes, well, the big thing did a couple of years ago, that maybe we'll move people from this part of the city to the other. And it's really just was, in that case, an off-the-cuff remark. There is no formal plan to do that, and there ought not to be. I don't know that we necessarily have to think of these as separate. I think that the other issue is, one of scale. I think a lot of the spaces that I'm referring to, and the reason I talked about the Toledo data and properties that have gone through tax reversion, are not areas that are privately owned right now. They're vacant right now. They're being used in it by community groups already. I think that there could be some, either, sort of formally, and I know Cleveland are formally talking about this as a parks network. We're not talking about this as sort of, language like decommissioning, which is a lot more negative than nice green park, but I think that the scale makes is the other aspect of this, and I think that a lot of the land in some of the neighborhoods that are, you know, extremely distressed is already publicly owned, and I think all I'm suggesting is that perhaps there's something other than simply trying to figure out a way to facilitate it back onto the private market that we can think about. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, a lot with, you know, a sign that says owned by the city of Pittsburgh and do not trespass, which I also think would have a big psychic disadvantage. It can be organized in the form of land trusts or in managed by community groups, who, many of whom are trying to get this stuff, you know, trying to get, you know, gardens and sort of programming and green space possibilities opened up in the neighborhoods anyway. So I don't think of it necessarily as one or the other, but I think that, that larger issue is looming in this whole policy arena, which is why I want to raise the issue. Thank you.
I'm Ann Lewis from Stu Valley Cog, and one of the things that I think it's really the idea of the sort of these broad swaths of open space are really intriguing. But for someone who works with local governments that don't have capacity, right, to maintain, and I understand the idea of letting things go green. And what we were just talking about back here is a sidebar, and would be really interesting to know. I mean, there's certainly the example of, you know, this conservation district, right, that drives the price of the house that you mentioned up significantly. But the fact that it's a conservation district indicates to me that there's a level of investment already in that land, and there's integrity in that land that might be drastically different from these are swaths of land and we're just going to kind of let them be natural, whatever that means. And I'm wondering if anybody has really looked at quantitatively the value of properties by, you know, that reside near vacant land and found some way to classify that vacant land in terms of your, because parks aren't free, they just, you know, they're just green, so that classify it from the raw, it's not maintained, it's not really invested in, it has some basic, you know, that's it, it's just raw land that's just growing, versus the other things, to see if there's a significant difference. Because if you're not driving up the values of the adjacent properties, then you're taking, then there is some credibility potentially economically to the fact that you're removing this land from the tax rolls and eliminating the ability to raise revenue on that land to support your activities. And it's, I mean, it's a really interesting, complicated.
I have lots of thoughts about this. Sounds very much like, I'm sure Susan walked her paper. I think she's actually written something specifically about the forms of vacancy that I suspect you're talking about, which is the you know, being next to either a vacant house or a vacant lot that's been untended, has a serious drag on property values, though I've not sort of formally considered it myself. And I don't know that she or anybody else that I know of, and correct me if I'm wrong, has actually classified it. I think that's a very meaningful classification. I just want to clarify a couple points. One, that the example I was using about Toronto, and I wish I could have shown it now because it's about a controversial comparison, but it actually was distinct from a park, and I understand that point, and I think that's a very important point to make, that by just sort of declaring every corner that's vacant and currently city-owned as a city park, that probably not only takes it off the tax rolls, but adds tax burden in the form of all sorts of things. So, and I just to clarify what they're talking about in Detroit Works and what I was referring to in Toronto, those are actually not tended to on a regular basis. I suspect that there's some, you know, office that is in charge of, you know, liability issues that as they arise, but they are distinct from actual parks or park heads in the sense that they're ravines or the things that are unbuildable for other reasons, and they're sensitive to that distinction, right? I think in the I don't know. I mean, the issue of whether or not this sort of reduces future tax revenue, I don't know. I think it actually depends on the details. And again, I'm not necessarily, I'm not a tax collector, but that's not necessarily what I'm trying to suggest. I think it could improve places. That's the central part. But I think an argument could be made, and I think they're essentially trying to suggest this in the Detroit case, is that by having so many sort of potentially purchasable lots, and they have lots of other tax collection problems that, you know, and I assume that some economists have sat down and looked at the numbers, or I hope so anyway, for their sake, that you would actually gain more by having the values increase on a certain number of parcels than on having incredibly low values elsewhere. From my perspective, though, I think if we go down that road, that I think we do have to ask serious questions about, as a public policy goal, specifically an affordable housing goal, how, if it were to succeed, we think about that, right? I mean, if we're having, you know, particularly people on fixed incomes, they're, many live in highly disinvested neighborhoods because that's with low assessments and would be incredibly disrupted, if not completely displaced, if there was a huge uptick in property value. So I don't think it's the end all and be all, but I would like to suggest that I think the way we, some of the most, you know, both from an economic value and sort of a human relation value, interesting spaces are both those in cities, are both those that are, you know, formally maintained and expensive, as you point out, and perhaps beyond the capacity, but also those that are relatively just untouched, ravines, these sorts of things. So.
Matt Smuts, Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment Group. To that point, just real quickly, I mean, we have an example of that in Pittsburgh with the greenways, and when I was at the Urban Redevelopment Authority, we looked at that somewhat, you know, not in depth, but, you know, we definitely saw that there was value around parks, you know, demonstrable value, whereas the value around the greenways, which are essentially set aside land in Pittsburgh, was questionable, if not actually a pulling down values. But I think you can also look at it over time so that maybe that's a temporary holding strategy where those spaces eventually become more well maintained or parks, but that there, I mean, in Pittsburgh, in the case of Pittsburgh, when the greenways were created, it was because there were steep slope areas or undermined that really probably shouldn't have ever been developed in the first place. So, but I think that that's one consideration to be made, that in the short term, they might not add value, but in the long term, as you sort of put together a system, you might be able to evolve them into something that does add value. And I was just going to make a comment about
that. Did you have that study? Can you send that to me?
It wasn't really a study. It was just sort of stuff we were looking at in terms of value. We might have done a little something, which I'll try to get. The other point to the comment about, you know, population of the country maybe increasing is a big one. You can't ignore, and obviously the liberals wouldn't like this sentiment, that the whole concept of controls on growth, especially in greenfield areas or suburban areas. I think if you look at the, you know, populations within cities, within populations within regions, you see that suburban or greenfield areas are growing potentially, while the urban areas are declining. And I know there's a bit of a shift in some areas, including Pittsburgh, in that regard. I think for a long time that's been looked at as being radical, but places like Portland have done that. And I know it sometimes creates other issues, but I think, you know, looking at as a nation, how we invest in infrastructure to serve those areas that are a lot more cost intensive, can't be ignored, to put controls on that and suddenly create more demand for the urban housing stuff that's already there.
They could. I don't know. I mean, I have a student who's sort of thinking about writing a dissertation on this very topic. I don't know how much it's about, like, as much feeling about it. I just don't feel like so much, especially, again, I bring up Detroit a lot, but so much is already. I do think that there's a component of this is sort of outward growth, and if you were to somehow be able to contain that growth, would it then sort of revive into this further in? I don't know. I mean, it could. I don't know. But I do feel like there's it's a component to this story that makes some places different than others, and I think in high growth areas, or growth places where there's actually some growth to the economic area, I think perhaps there's maybe more of a chance of that occurring than in others. But it would take a level of regional cooperation that probably just impractical at this point, or as impractical as maybe even some of my ideas. But but I do think it's something, right, that Portland's the case that everyone, all the economists talk about, right, that where some lauded as, you know, great and sort of limited growth, the economists have pointed out, of course, that it has increased assessments are made probably more expensive in the inner city. I don't know, sometimes it's just, I think, that the cities in the upper Midwest are just so different, it's hard to make that comparison. So, mixed feelings.
I'm David Wolwell. I'm a planner with the Hampshire Authority in Pittsburgh. And just comment on the metrics you're using to measure decline. Population's a big one. I don't want to minimize what's gone on in Pittsburgh since 1950, but I know that even with all the data you work with, a lot of this concept working in that respect. And when you're looking at decline in population trends, you also have to look at non-residential properties too. And thinking along, we have a rapid transit busway in downtown Eastern communities, and the population in those communities has declined up through around 1990, significantly bottom off a little bit, but they're still declining. However, investment in the corridor, inventory investment in the busway, we've identified $800 million worth of investment between 1993 and 2008. More development is still going on. And it's, I find it kind of fascinating that even with this population decline, there is still all of this development. One of the developments, for example, is Fort Truth that came in, I don't know if this is still the case, but it's their highest sale per foot in the community stores. So there is that, I think you have to look at that dimension.
Yeah, and it's
Thank you, Chair. Your last line, the idea of decline, I mean, it may be that population decline isn't about declining lifestyles, but quality of life.
I mean, it brings up a lot of thoughts, and it's interesting, even in the places it's somewhat related to the previous point about that there is a kind of organic, I mean, using that word in these contexts, but I do think that there's some element of it that's not more to an organic concentration of economic activity, often around transit lines, that's even occurring in places like Detroit, where things are just, you know, dispersed, where things are really inexpensive. There's basically, along Woodward, there's there's not only current kind of decent public transportation, but proposed right light rail that's going along there, and the commercial and the housing work hand in hand. And so I think that there is somewhat of a concentration, I guess, that's already occurring. And I guess that's why I think the idea of sort of formalizing that or incentivizing that or sort of building around that in the form of isn't necessarily that radical necessarily. There's other parts of the city that have that are already owned by the public. I mean, your point about the commercial real estate, I would love to get into more commercial real estate. It's purely a pragmatic matter. I do not see them as detached from one another, but it's, as a social scientist, there's just so much more data about housing than there is about commercial real estate that I can afford anyway. I absolutely think of them as related, and that my other sense with commercial real estate disinvestment or commercial disinvestment is that it's a much more sort of, the impact is greater, but the N is lower, the number of cases. You know, you have places like Youngstown, you have two steel mills go, and the entire city is gone. There's only so much can be said about, you know, there's one, there's a couple of players of much more sophisticated urban economy like Pittsburgh that may have been, you know, the numbers might be different, but the scale, the frequency of housing abandonment is just, as a social scientist, I sort of salivate at the numbers that you can kind of get a clear sense of pattern. It's pure pragmatics.
Yeah, just a quick one. In that Detroit plan, isn't one of the goals of of that to sort of reduce the tax, I'm sorry, David Weber from the Housing Authority, to sort of reduce the tax burden by taking some of the existing infrastructure that you no longer would have to maintain in other areas?
Yes, I think this is part of the point, although I don't think that they spelled it out, and I'm curious how they intend to do that, because they're also emphatic about not relocating people. I think that, yeah, the idea is that there would be, you know, that the city that was infrastructurally built for 2 million people now has 700,000 people, and that means that there's many full streets with one or two families living on them, and they're connected to the storm, you know, the sewage system, and the electricity, and all this, you know, the other networks like police and fire. And so the thought is that, that there would be some either incentivizing people to relocate elsewhere or in more concentrated locations, or I think it has to be an and/or, if they're not talking about relocating, converting some lots to septic systems or something of that sort. I don't know how you would get around that. I mean, I think, again, part of it is an idea issue, too. Like, again, I keep bringing up this, I grew up a couple hundred miles west of here. We lived in we had sewer, right? But we didn't have outhouses either. We had plumbing. We had, that doesn't necessarily, there's lots of people in the United States and Canada who live off of kind of formal infrastructure grids, but that aren't living literally off the grid, that there's ways of kind of constructing residential patterns even within cities. And maybe Detroit's different in the sense that it's so vast that we have to think about it almost in that way. But I don't personally think that's necessarily impossible. I guess who then pays for the retrofitting of sewer systems or septic systems would have to come into play. But yes, I think this is part of the goal, is to sort of reduce the tax burden or the expense burden by the infrastructure.
Daryl Graff on Swissvale Borough Council. I'm interested in the scale that some of this analysis can be done accurately on, and that you can get kind of good statistics. You're talking about the city of Pittsburgh, but which has decreased by that much, and there are communities. But there has been a shift to the suburbs. It probably wouldn't be reasonable to apply this to one individual municipality of 10,000 people, but, whether there's kind of a size or population or number of housing units or something that this kind of analysis would, in terms of the foreclosure or the distressed census tracts and things like that, would reasonably be applied to.
I don't know that I have a lot of sophisticated thoughts about that. I mean, I do think that there's, within the kind of matter of dealing with numbers, the bigger the probably the better in terms of trying to identify patterns. Alan, actually, a lot of people bring him, he's the father in some ways of the map that I showed you, has tried to apply it to smaller cities, Saginaw, which I think is below 100,000 right now, and used it in much smaller geographic areas. I gave this impression. I certainly don't think that we should ever, whether it's Pittsburgh, Detroit, wherever we're talking about, we shouldn't stop with the population statistics or the market distress statistics that I showed you before. And I think that maybe the most valuable metric is these sort of property by property considerations, which, and locating them, and some of the stuff I was doing in Toledo, which other scholars have picked up. There are some firms that actually, buy data. I'm actually in the process of buying some from DataQuick, where you can actually look at property by property sales transactions. So I think the more fine-grained, the better. But I personally do think that there's some value in scoping out a bit and kind of, because it, at least in a comparative sense, I think it can only say so much in a sort of case study sense, but in a comparative sense, it creates a, even at the broadest scale, population and consideration of where the boundaries are and what where market distress is occurring sets the table, I think, for a lot of these other more microscopic processes that we can measure or as community activists see occurring on a day-to-day level. That I think there is some value in it. I don't have any particular threshold that it works for the size city versus that. I think even the
I'll take my moderator's prerogative and also moderator's role. This will be the last question, and Jason's happy to stay a few minutes and chat with you. But let's take the neoliberalism theory a bit further in terms of decommissioning land. And here in this area, we don't look like Detroit and other places because we have lots of industrialists in the 19th century that set up plants and created new towns. And then they could not, the state then ended annexation. So those towns literally were built around a plant or a factory or a steel mill. Ceased to exist, and those towns look like, you know, a place you could do a map in Pittsburgh, including the river towns. That would be about decommissioning towns. You can imagine how controversial that's been.
Yes, I suspect.
But you put Bob Herbert and Rush Limbaugh in the same basket to compare.
They're very different people. I just wanted to note the remarkable similarity.
I don't think many people would have found a place to put them in the same basket. But think about what does that mean in the in urban policy after neoliberalism? How would people react to the idea that decommissioning land really got tied to decommissioning communities? Because obviously many of these communities have only 1,000 or 2,000 people left.
I'm certainly not advocating that, and I'm not sure anyone who is. I do think that in those cities, I suspect you're talking about places like Braddock and these, you know, that there's some value to be had. I still feel like at some scale of repurposing, perhaps is a better euphemism for than decommissioning, land that, that the privately bought and sold parcels are not the only way to improve the conditions. And I think this is, though labeling it as decommissioning is obviously deliberately provoking something. I do think that even for smaller cities, that almost specifically in those cases, because I think that they were originally built in a much more organized way around a factory or a train station or next to a port facility on the river, that I think that there's a lot of potential of kind of reorganizing the land use scheme in a sense that might provide some synchronization with other economic development efforts. I don't think of them as necessarily separate. I mean, the other thing is the point about Limbaugh and Herbert being in the same sentence. I think it actually underscores in my intent in putting them in the same sentence is that there's something more to this than simply a KM Institute decree, right? This is something that there's a skepticism or a connection that we draw, and who the we is, I don't know, but I mean, I do think that there's an automatic association that this is, you know, a pathway to something that's really negative if but I think that government and economy work, especially at the urban scale, are inextricably linked together, and that there's land use planning can even converting land that isn't and is currently private into something else, collective, community owned, land trust, whatever, has some potential value in a variety of senses.
That brings back some of the comments that Majestic had and also Ann Lewis. But Jason, I want to thank you very much. We've had a great day.